It has been a group of legislators operating in a closed room without adequate input, just trying to solve a math problem.
Anchorage's mayor weighs in on the latest budget balancing proposals from the legislature. On the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 29th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a record-setting low for sea ice coverage in the Arctic Ocean.
You know, if I look at December, January, February averaged air temperatures, over the poles are almost 12 degrees Celsius above normal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Nearly 10,000 Alaskans have connected with the Salmon Project, sharing their passion for salmon all across this state. Join the growing family of people united by the love for this resource and the unique Alaskan ways of life. Visit salmonlife.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Senators introduced four new bills yesterday that would require local governments and schools to pay more for pensions, end two college scholarship programs, and cut the amount that municipalities receive in state funding. Municipalities and schools are concerned about the effect on taxes and services. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The first measure, Senate Bill 207, would shift much of the cost of teacher pensions from the state onto local school districts. Fairbanks Republican Senator Pete Kelly, who supports the change, says he wants to ease the impact on districts.
Obviously, the state is in pretty difficult times. There are some things that we simply can't do anymore. And it's important, though, that as we recognize those things that the state can't afford to do anymore, that we mitigate the impact on communities and provide as many shock absorbers as we can.
Association of Alaska School Boards Executive Director Norm Wooten says districts fear the effect of the higher costs.
My members are very concerned. There's some short-term and some long-term uncomfortableness about this. Short-term is that districts have already issued teacher contracts. They're putting the final touches on their budgets, and yet they still don't know not only what they're not going to get, but what they're going to lose.
In the long term, Wooten says districts could cut programs and lay off staff. The increased costs would be offset in at least the first year by the second measure, Senate Bill 208. This would phase out two college funding programs, Alaska Performance Scholarships for students with high grades and test scores, and Alaska Education Grants for students with financial need. These programs would be wound down by 2022. A portion of the fund that paid for these programs would be used to lower school districts' pension contributions. The third piece of legislation, Senate Bill 209, would also increase local pension contributions. Municipal and other government bodies that contribute to the public employees' retirement system would have to pay more. They currently pay the equivalent of 22% of salaries, but would have to pay 4.5% more by 2018. Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz, a former legislator, says the bill was poorly thought out and didn't include municipal perspectives.
When they say that everything's put on the table, that doesn't mean you're carving up the municipalities and treating them like cash cows. And that's what they're trying to do right now. That's not acceptable. This has not been a process that has included municipal governments. It's not been a process that's included taxpayers. It has been a group of legislators operating in a closed room without adequate input, just trying to solve a math problem.
The fourth bill, Senate Bill 210, will cut the total amount the state pays to communities as revenue sharing in half, but it would increase the minimum payments to help protect rural communities. Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Democrat who caucuses with the majority, says the state can't afford to continue the program in its current form.
Assisting those communities, primarily smaller communities throughout the state of Alaska that rely heavily upon the program, that may have 80, 90, 95% of their revenues to continue to keep their doors open. Whereas larger communities, they may only, this program may be less than 5% of their revenue, and they can probably make better adjustments.
Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Kathy Wasserman says the cost of all these changes could be large.
All I know is it's going to be a huge impact. You can't hand a state bill over to municipalities, lower the amount of money they get, and then hand them an extra bill and not have a huge impact.
Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says the bills were a necessary step to help close a state deficit of more than $4 billion. The four bills could provide about $100 million, although the fiscal analysis must be completed.
This suite of bills is attempting to address, you know, a huge hole in Alaska's budget. And it is a suite of bills that work together, and there is criticism to be had for any of the bills individually. But our goal is, taken as a whole, that these bills will provide an opportunity for communities to understand the magnitude of the problem that the state is facing.
McKinnon and Kelly co-chair the Senate Finance Committee. The committee plans to announce opportunities for public testimony on the four bills. In Juneau, this is Andrew Kitchenman.
Scientists say warm winter weather around the circumpolar north has led to another record-setting year of decreasing sea ice coverage of the Arctic Ocean. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the extent of sea ice formed over the past winter was even smaller than the previous record low extent set last year.
National Snow and Ice Data Center Director Mark Serez struggled for words a few weeks ago to describe the warmest of last winter's weather.
It was just crazy warm. I've really never seen anything like it.
Scientists with the center again cited the weird weather Monday when they announced the amount of sea ice that formed over the winter in the Arctic Ocean was, for the second year, far below average. The average based on when the center began satellite monitoring sea ice in 1981.
You know, if I look at December, January, February averaged air temperatures, over the poles they're almost 12 degrees Celsius above normal. So that's a huge anomaly in the temperatures for the Arctic.
Julian Struva is a senior research scientist with the center, and she says some of that warmth came from El Nino and the Blob, the mass of warm water that parked in the North Pacific late last year. Struva says those phenomena won't be present next year, so it seems unlikely the sea ice extent at the end of next winter will set another record, but she says the overall trend is clear.
The long-term warming from, you know, increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, all climate models show that we're going to continue to lose the sea ice.
The Denver-based National Snow and Ice Data Center says sea ice extended an average of 5.6 million square miles over the Arctic Ocean as of Thursday. That's about 5,000 square miles less than last year's maximum sea ice extent. Serez, the center director, says that suggests the sea ice minimum recorded at the end of summer may also break that record set in 2012.
Where it sits in the record books depends on the summer weather patterns, and we just can't predict that.
The center will issue its report on the minimum sea ice extent in September. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is in Alaska holding field hearings as the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Monday, she invited leaders from the state's energy, mining, and labor sectors to offer their perspectives on how the federal government is doing its job managing public lands. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, most of the testimony expressed frustration with federal regulations and how they're implemented.
Nobody seemed happy with the status quo Monday, inside or outside the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Facility, where Senator Lisa Murkowski conducted her field hearings. Outside, 15 or 20 protesters bore placards urging action on climate change and weaning the economy off fossil fuels. Eric Schetzel says more is in play than oil patch jobs and dwindling dollars in the state's coffers.
This is a health issue. It's a social justice issue. There's a lot more than just our economy at stake here. There's future generations. So we're really talking about what sort of legacy we want to leave.
Schetzel was signed up to offer testimony at the hearing, but inside, Senator Murkowski made it clear the focus of the meeting was to hear from industry and labor leaders, and she wasn't happy with the way bureaucrats and protesters hampered industry and commerce.
This is a time when we should be opening our lands and waters to responsible development, streamlining the permitting process, and working to ensure that protests and litigation do not hold us back.
Murkowski's point was taken up and echoed by mining, energy, and labor executives, as well as Alaska Native representatives who offered comments. One reoccurring frustration expressed by industry leaders like Lorelei Simon of Usabelli Coal Mine aimed less at regulations and more at those who enforced them.
It is true that in order for any of us to do our jobs, we need a stable regulatory environment. We just want to know what the rules are so that we can play by the rules.
Also looming over the hearing, as Senator Murkowski acknowledged in her remarks, was the knowledge that the fall's presidential election could radically alter the regulatory landscape. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, online farmers markets start up on the Kenai Peninsula, and their offerings are diverse.
We hope to include some crafts and possibly even some cottage food products like kimchi and breads.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The municipality of Anchorage is launching a new initiative to make the community and the economy more inclusive. The city received a grant to participate in the Gateways for Growth Challenge. The goal is to develop a strategic plan for incorporating new arrivals from rural Alaska and other parts of the world into the city's economy. Mara Kimmel, the mayor's wife and co-founder of the Alaska Institute for Justice, who is spearheading the project, says it's about more than just getting people jobs. It's about helping them maximize their skill sets.
This gives us the opportunity to figure out who's out there, what skills and expertise they bring, and then how we can mobilize those skills to the benefit of our economy. And in these days of shrinking economic resources, it's really important that we activate everybody. And that everybody, we tear down barriers to entry to our marketplaces and to our community.
Kimmel says they will look at things like language barriers and limited public transportation. The grant and matching funds from the state and Wells Fargo total about $30,000. The money will be used to conduct research around the city with individuals and organizations about how to make Anchorage a more inclusive place and to expand entrepreneurship. More than 40 community businesses, nonprofits, and government agencies are participating. 20 communities around the country received the grants. Alaska's star-crossed educational testing system suffered another setback today when a fiber optic cable near the University of Kansas was severed at about 10:30 this morning, Alaska time. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The University of Kansas is home to AAI, the Achievement and Assessment Institute, which provides online standardized testing to school districts across Alaska. The incident left students high and dry in grades 3, 7, and 8 in Sitka as they began the first day of the Alaska Measures of Progress, or AMP, testing. Co-Assistant Superintendent Sarah Ferenczi is in charge of testing in the Sitka School District. When no one could connect to the online testing service, her first impulse was to get AAI on the phone.
And I got a "Sorry, we are closed" message, and I was like, "What? Really?" So then I went and I, you know, tried to get onto the computer interface, and that was down too, and that is what had happened to students who were testing, is just they tried to log on and they couldn't even log on because the whole system was down.
In fact, most of the University of Kansas campus was down. According to a university news release, the cable had been accidentally severed somewhere just off campus in the city of Lawrence. Internet, online classes, even email was unavailable to the majority of campus for the rest of the afternoon. Ferenczi thinks the 75 students from Sitka and any others statewide who were taking the test when the connection was lost should be fine.
The system is designed so that if there is any disconnection for any reason, that all answers are saved. So we anticipate that students who were in the test at the time of the outage will be able to just log right back in and pick up where they left off.
The AMP has been under fire almost constantly since it was introduced, and especially since last January when the Department of Education decided to replace it with another testing product. But that transition couldn't happen very quickly, so the AMP remains in use this year. Although it doesn't look good, Ferenczi says this outage is not another reason to dislike the AMP.
Does not help the public perception. You know, the State Department was very clear when they finally sent an email that said, you know, what was happening, that this has nothing to do with AAI. I mean, it really doesn't. A construction vehicle clipped a fiber optic cable outside the campus. And so it really, I mean, yeah, it's incredibly unfortunate and incredibly bad timing, but it's really no fault of theirs.
As of press time, the State Department of Education had no estimate of how many students across the state may have been affected by the outage. Ferenczi says this was the first day of testing. Students in Sitka who were unable to log on will likely get another opportunity to take the test in about 3 weeks. The University of Kansas has announced that the cable should be repaired by Wednesday morning. And is this the death of online standardized testing in Alaska? Ferenczi doesn't think so. Every modern assessment service is moving online, she says. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
About 33 law enforcement officers and first responders from 10 different federal, state, and local agencies in Ketchikan recently came together for a two-day anti-terrorism training event. They learned how to be more aware of potential terrorism plots and, just as important, built interagency relationships. KRBD's Layla Carey talked with two of the local participants, City of Ketchikan Fire Chief Abner Hoga and Alaska State Troopers Captain Michael Duxbury, and has this report.
I'm going to guess what you're thinking. Terrorism in Ketchikan? Get real. Because terrorists like to make a big splash and won't attack some little town on an island in Alaska, right? Well, Captain Duxbury, who's worked as a trooper with the FBI on the Joint Terrorism Task Force and previously led the state's criminal intelligence unit, says it's not as unlikely for Alaska as many might believe.
Alaska's within approximately 9.5 hours of the world's major hubs for transportation of goods and the airports. And we have a population that's 63%, I believe, in the last census comes from somewhere else. So we have an exchange here and an ability to exchange with the rest of the world that is almost unprecedented for how small a population we have.
So that's the state, but what about small towns like Ketchikan? Hogue, who's Ketchikan's emergency manager, says one thing they learned in the training is that a lot of terrorism plots start in smaller communities.
And then they move the materials to where the attack takes place because they don't want to be noticed until they're ready to be noticed.
So it is possible in small town Alaska, but what can be done about it? The training, they say, focused on increasing awareness. They learned what to watch out for as first responders, and they encourage local residents to also be vigilant. But both Hogue and Duxbury stressed, terrorism is not confined to any one group.
We don't want people to focus on religion or national origin or any of that. Focus on the behaviors. You know what's going on in your community. You know what's normal and what's not. And if you see something that's not normal, report it.
But what counts as not normal? I mean, this is Alaska, after all. Even in Alaska, though, it's a little strange for someone who doesn't own a specific kind of business to start buying large quantities of certain chemicals, for example.
Maybe acetone. You're not in the painting
some
business.
Some sort of chemical.
Some sort of chemical.
Seems out of the ordinary. Industrial-grade products when you don't have an industrial-type business that you're operating.
Or you notice that a business has lots of people coming and going at odd hours, and some of them appear to be living in the business. Or a group of neighbors all suddenly experience a rash of thefts from their shops or garages. And Duxbury says it's important to note that telling law enforcement when you see something strange doesn't necessarily mean you're getting a neighbor in trouble. Law enforcement still needs to go through a process to determine whether that something is something that needs further investigation.
Professionalism does not dictate that you give me a piece of information and I go running to that person and say, hey, he told me, what are you doing, and shake somebody. No, we're violating people's rights. And civil rights are important to all of us. And that's why we live in Alaska, most of us. I mean, because we have a pretty strong constitution here, right?
Getting back to the question of can it happen here? Terrorism is not only a violent means of expressing an extreme religious ideology. Hogue says it can be anyone using violence to promote an agenda. There are some issues specific to Alaska, especially Southeast Alaska, that generate a lot of passion in people, such as environmental protection versus resource extraction.
And when you think about it in that sense, there are things going on in the state of Alaska and even here locally that someone could try to influence policy, whether it be state or federal policy, at a local level.
One area in Ketchikan that many local residents might consider a likely target for terrorists is the downtown cruise dock. Duxbury says that is a potential target because terrorism is about symbolism and making a symbolic statement.
We have 940,000 people. They came from all over the world. We wouldn't even have to harm anybody but scare a bunch of people, and we'd have an impact all over the world.
But the best way to counter that kind of impact is through awareness and cooperation. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Cooperation across the Bering Strait was strengthened last week when the U.S. and Russia signed a joint wildlife agreement. Officials from the two Arctic nations met in San Diego to discuss polar bear and snow goose monitoring efforts in Alaska and Chukotka. Stephen Cole heads the Eurasian effort at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and was at the meeting.
So many of these animals spend part of the year on the Russian side of the international dateline and part of the year on the Alaskan side.
It's for that reason that the two nations have met every 2 or 3 years since 1972. That's when the U.S. and the then Soviet Union signed the original environmental agreement, despite Cold War tensions. Cole says strained relations between the two nations aren't getting in the way of joint management efforts.
Things have gone very well, and both sides, the scientists and administrators, are making a concerted effort to keep things going, even during the rough times that the two countries are experiencing in their relations right now.
Cole says the two parties plan to meet again in Anchorage this November. They'll review survey data and set quotas for polar bear and snow goose populations. He says in the next 2 years, Russian and American scientists will also be collaborating on a walrus survey in the Bering Sea. Farmers markets are going virtual. Soon, Kenai Peninsula residents will be able to buy locally grown food online. The new marketplaces are called food hubs. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
There's still snow outside, but Emily Garrity is preparing for the growing season inside her passive solar greenhouse on her small farm at the top of Olson Mountain, just outside Homer. She's made her own potting soil, and she's dropping seeds into wooden trays.
Here I have all my seeds organized by variety. And we have some King Richard leeks, and we'll just drop one or two seeds in every hole.
For the past 8 years, she's sold her produce through a community-supported agriculture subscription, or CSA, where people pay a set amount for a box of food from her on a regular basis. She also has a stand at the Homer Farmers Market, but this year she's trying something new. The Homer Food Hub.
You can think of the food hub as an online farmer's market.
That's Robbie Mixon, the local foods coordinator for Cook Inlet Keeper, which is hosting the website. Mixon knows a lot about farmer's markets. She's run the one in Homer for 5 years. Now she's helping set up the food hub website.
Producers from growing produce to fish. We hope to include some crafts and possibly even some cottage food products like kimchi and breads.
Here's how it works. Producers will list what they have available for the week. Customers can then place orders and pay through the website. Then they can pick up their order at a fixed location at a set day and time. Mixon says communities on the peninsula have been kicking around the idea of an online farmers market for a few years. But after Cook Inlet Keeper won a grant of around $89,000 from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to get it started, everything seemed to come together. Rachel Lord, who also works for Cook Inlet Keeper as the Clean Water Program Director, wrote the grant that's funding the project. The nonprofit is usually focused on protecting the Cook Inlet watershed, not running a market. But Lord says the project is in line with the organization's values. Lord says that creating a food hub fits with Cook Inlet Keeper's larger version of a sustainable future for the region.
Most of our food is coming in from outside. It's coming in through shipping channels, and we're pretty vulnerable. We also expend a lot of carbon in getting our food here.
And the food hub isn't just going to be about fruits and vegetables. Hannah Heimbuck is a commercial fisherman.
I fish for halibut and salmon.
She's also the community fisheries organizer for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. She says there are some challenges for fishermen to participate in the food hub. She's not sure how they'll get their fish to customers, but she has ideas that may work.
Maybe it will be that they're able to offer a gilled and gutted whole fish from the deck of their vessel down at the harbor. Maybe we can connect customers in through the food hub to that product. Some fishermen are able to go ahead and process and vacuum seal their fish, and that's another option that we could have available in the food hub.
Heimbach says rockfish would make a great product along with salmon and halibut. In addition, she's already working with local shellfish producers to bring oysters to the hub. There'll be one food hub in the Homer area, Lord says. The Central Peninsula will also get one. Stephen Dahl runs 3-acre Eagle Glade Farm near Kenai, where he and his wife grow specialty garlic and onions, among other things. He usually sells produce at local farmers markets, but now he's prepping to sell through the Central Peninsula Food Hub. He thinks the hub will be more affordable for shoppers and socially responsible.
In a way, it'll be more economical because it'll be here. Instead of paying for food that was grown at some place with extremely cheap labor and then paying for the shipping to send it all the way to some other place.
Back in Homer, Garrity agrees. She says she's excited about the opportunity to capture a wider market for her products, too.
I think in this day and age, people are really used to online shopping. And I think it's a progressive way to get more people involved and make it easier to get local foods and local products in people's homes and on their tables.
Garrity says she's planting about 50% more this season to provide produce for the Homer Food Hub. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And finally tonight, a correction. Yesterday, we aired a story about a state Supreme Court decision that requires the state to enforce child support orders issued by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. In it, we referenced an agreement signed earlier this month by the tribe and state that concerns tribal children in foster care, but mischaracterized it as being related to tribal child support. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsley in Sitka, Lila Carey in Ketchikan, Emily Russell in Nome, and Daisha Eaton in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc. Get away and stay in Alaska at UAS Juneau. Small enough that your professors know you by name. Big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new freshman residence hall. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.